I, Warlock. The Warlock Wars, Book 1. Written by M.A. McNeice. Narrated by Sean Reed. Part 1. One of a Kind. Chapter 1. Grief is not linear. It's one of the most important things I've learned in my very long existence. Taught to me by a grief counselor I saw for several months during the darkest time of my life. It doesn't have a beginning, middle, and end. Jacqueline Ward, the counselor, told the small group of us that we would mourn for many years to come, in many ways. This was especially numbing to hear, considering how long I could expect to live. She said, "It is more like a wave, receding for a time, then swelling, sometimes crashing down on us in those terrible moments when the loss of someone becomes acute and we struggle to accept that we will never see them again." For me, it was compounded by knowing this was true for everyone I've loved. Outliving them all only turned the losses from severe to chronic, a dull, ever-present ache I feel even now. Other people think grief is some kind of station stop on a train we ride, and once a certain amount of time has passed, we're expected to move on. They lose patience with us, as if our duty is not to remember the loved ones we've lost, but to help them forget, to make them less uncomfortable in our presence. It's not something I've ever been good at, or wanted to comply with. Other people's reactions to my sorrow are not my problem. They can go on and live their grief-free lives. They just can't expect sympathy from me when it happens to them. And it will. To live is to know loss. To live long is to know an emptiness in the soul that had once been filled by people. It's the price of being human. Even if, like me, you're only part human. For me, it's the part that grieves, and the part that was determined to have my revenge. Living forever was never in the job description. In fact, I'd place it last on my list of demands if I ever had to interview for a position as a warlock. Luckily, I didn't have any competition at the time of my ascension. There's nothing else to call it. I wasn't elected. I didn't rise through the ranks. I was born a warlock, and when I came at the age of 13, I was burdened with the future I had not asked for or wanted. Becoming what I am is not something I aspired to. It just happened. One day I was little Julius Tide, prepubescent annoyance to the adults in my life, and the next day I was a prince among witches. I took none of it for granted, mind you. And had it not been for an upbringing by a half-dozen members of a coven that included my mother and two aunts, I would not have been prepared in any way for what was expected of me. I never considered myself above the witches in my life. I wasn't in for power or prestige. In many ways, I was a sort of accidental warlock, born and bred into it with the kind of luck of the draw that has always benefited wealthy people and royalty. I came into being having drawn the long stick, so to speak. My mother, Audrey Tide, maiden name Daly, was a strong-willed woman in every respect, including marrying a man her family disapproved of and whose only impressive features were his name and his destiny as a half-vampire. Augustus Tide came from a line of men who preferred pretentious names and bad habits. His single bit of good fortune in life, if you consider it that, was having his assault by a down-on-her-luck vampire interrupted by a group of hoodlums who mistook her for easy prey. I hadn't been born yet. That would come 2 years later. But ridiculously named Augustus had been drinking in an unfamiliar bar in an unfamiliar Vermont town, and he'd been set upon by a woman posing as a prostitute. Daddy was known for his casual infidelities, so I was later told, and his readiness to employ a sex worker of any class was not what shocked the senses, but what happened next. To his near-fatal surprise, it was his neck she wanted, nothing in the lower extremities, and had the thugs not followed her there, expecting some quick change in a little harmless robbery, he would have been drained and left for undead. According to the story he told 1,000 times, and which my mother ignored just as often, the vampire defended herself quite heroically, dispatching the 3, or 4, or 6, depending on his telling, thieves, before being shot by the bartender. Apparently the saloon owner was fine with my father being murdered, for all intents and purposes, in a dark back booth, but not with the attention the slaughter she'd accomplished would bring to his fine establishment. He pumped her full of shot from a sawed-off. She was unhappy about it, and while she took her displeasure out on the man who'd served his last drink, my father managed to escape out a back door, wounded, but not feasted upon enough to make it more than a lifelong ailment. He was only half vampire, a condition that would make him a misfit the rest of his days, and that would give his offspring the gift of excruciatingly long lives. My mother is dead. My father is buried. My sister lives in secrecy. I am a warlock. Chapter 2. Charlotte and I moved to New York City in 1962. I've been told that someone with my condition, vampire-blooded and warlock-raised, can expect to live 2 centuries at least. That makes me middle-aged in normal human years, give or take a decade. But I'm not normal. Had I been, you would not be hearing this story, and I would not be telling it. The length of years someone like me lives has a way of distorting everything, creating a strange and unfamiliar center. Halfway to dead for someone like me is long buried for almost everyone else. Almost. That's the key, the central axis around which everything else turns. For I am not alone. There are others like me, some of them distinctly not like me. There are vampires, witches, and warlocks, sorcerers, and, so it's rumored, an occasional werewolf. I've encountered quite a few of them, and wish I'd never met one in particular, but it became my mission to meet him again, and to put an end to him. Once I'd accomplished that seemingly insurmountable feat, if, in fact, it could be done, I would gladly die. It could be a moment after I'd finished him, or 20 years later. With him dead, I would welcome my own passing from this vale of tears. New York is not a place I ever intended to live. I'd grown up in a small Vermont town that will remain nameless to protect the guilty. Some of my mother's kind still thrive there, and I'd rather not add them to the list of the hunted. It's been a long list for centuries, its victims ranging from the truly deserving to the undeniably innocent. I'm not sure where the coven we belong to falls in that continuum, but Corinne still lives in the area and has managed to avoid detection all these years. Why ruin it for her? Charlotte was the one who wanted to move to the city, and not just any city, the one so famous that it's simply called the city by everyone who lives within 100 miles of its magnificent skyline. I will grant it that, despite the misgivings I've always had about the place. She'd marveled at stories about it in magazines and cooed over images on the old black-and-white Zenith television her family had in their living room. "We must go there," she'd said one morning, after returning from lunch in town with my mother and sister. Charlotte knew them as a widow and her daughter, not as women steeped in the arts, black, white, or otherwise. "Someday," I'd replied.
"When, Julius? Let's make plans now. A trip to New York would be so marvelous, don't you think?"
I knew she'd wanted to get away, to go anywhere else after the events of the previous months. She had wanted to flee, to outrun them, as it were, without ever saying this was her motive. I had no way of knowing the price we would pay for our escape. I considered making excuses not to go, only to surrender within minutes. I booked tickets on a train for the following weekend, and our destinies were sealed. You can see Manhattan from far off, and as you approach it, the sight can take your breath away. Its skyscrapers grow with each passing mile, simultaneously imposing and inviting. To the unjaded mind, it appears as the Emerald City must have appeared to Dorothy and her ragtag band of misfits, as a shimmering, promising destination where adventure awaits. That it is instead a final resting place of broken dreams and anonymous tragedies is lost only on those who have spent no real time in the shadows of its monoliths. I have been here for many years, much of them preparing for war and surviving skirmishes, taking casualties when they were unavoidable. I know the truth of the city, each promise a peril, each invitation a trap. But for a brief moment in time, Charlotte was delighted, and her happiness lulled me into thinking it would last forever. I stayed for revenge. I stayed as a spider stays in a corner of its web, waiting to pounce on a particular prey. Did he know where I was? Given his stealth and his genius for avoiding capture, I'd say he was aware of me from the moment we stepped off the train. He of no name I'm willing to speak for now. It so fouls my mouth. But the time was coming. I had to believe that, the way the foolish believe in heaven, when I would form his name into a word, and I would spit it out with such ferocity that the world would quake. It was my mission, my raison d'être. It was what I lived for, and what, if it came to that, I would die for.